You're listening to Your Financial Planner Now What, the podcast to help you fast-track your career by bringing you meaningful conversations on topics that influence new financial planners, their careers, and the lives of their clients. Here's your host, Hannah Moore, a CFP and the owner of Guiding Wealth Management.
Hello, and welcome to the show. Some of my most valuable learning opportunities have come from people outside the financial planning profession, and Laura Youngkin is no exception. Laura is the founder of The Brave Millennial, which is an organization dedicated to supporting and promoting millennial women in the American workforce. In 2016, Laura hosted 11 forums for millennial women in 9 cities across the United States. She has surveyed and interviewed hundreds of women in an effort to learn more about this generation, and will be telling this story at the upcoming South by Southwest conference in Austin. In addition to this work, Laura is a theatrical producer and creative consultant. Laura spent 5 years at Walt Disney Imagineering and has done numerous projects in the entertainment industry. I'm excited to share her story and perspective with you. Well, thanks for joining us today, Laura.
Happy to be here, Hannah.
So you started The Brave Millennial, where you went around the country having conversations with millennial women. Why did you do this, and what did you learn through this experience?
Oh, I've learned so much through this experience. So I started this project, I kind of got the idea for it in the summer of 2015. I had been working in the entertainment industry about 10 years, and I think as young women, we're accustomed to having to work a little bit harder. You kind of know in certain industries or in certain workplaces or in anything you're doing that the cards are kind of stacked against you. And I think from my experience and from talking with other women my age, we're now in our early 30s. When we were in our early 20s, we really felt the age thing, the age bias was coming at us. Oh, you're young, you're inexperienced, et cetera. So that was the first hurdle. And then as we got older, it wasn't so much about age as it was about this kind of unspoken, you could feel this kind of unspoken or unconscious bias coming towards you, and it really has to do with gender. And so I was having a lot of conversations about getting ahead, talking with women in my former company, in my industry, in my city, just about their opportunities for advancement and how they were faring in their career. And I felt like these conversations were happening behind closed doors, you know what I mean? They're really happening in offices or hallways or at happy hour, et cetera, because we don't really want to talk about these issues out loud at work. And so I felt like, gosh, I would really love to just get all of these people together and have a bigger conversation about the challenges that we are experiencing and then come up with some solutions or figure out a way to overcome them. How can we put together some action items that will help us as well as help others? As millennial women are the most educated group of women in history, but that's not currently being reflected in the American workforce. And so it really started out of just curiosity and wanting to help one another advance and perform well. So I hosted one and it went really well and I learned a lot and I thought, gosh, you know, I'm a producer. I bet I could whip up, you know, 5 or 6 or 7, maybe 10 of these forums across America and I wonder what I would find out. So it was really just my kind of insatiable curiosity that drove me as well as my desire for truly advancing my peers and figuring out the best way to do that. So instead of just kind of coming out with a set of solutions. 2016 was really about digging in and doing my homework. So that's why I produced this tour and went to 9 cities and hosted 11 forums and surveyed close to 300 women. And I learned so much. So the things that I've learned, some of the things did not surprise me. When I ask all of these women, you know, name your top 5 challenges in your career, like, and these women are across the U.S. and across a variety of industries, okay, so, and all different income levels, background, education, et cetera, and almost across the board, advancement and promotions and compensation ranked in the top 2. Behind that was work-life balance and work hours. So this is a group that's working a lot, a group that is close to burnout, has experienced burnout, and it's a group that is really challenged in terms of advancing in role and responsibility and title in their career and whatever path they're in, as well as compensation. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about compensation today. Another thing that I've learned that's really encouraging, actually, is, you know, in all of these conversations, it's a three-hour event. You attended in Dallas. It's a three-hour event, and I kind of structure the talk and the conversation around the survey feedback from that particular city. So every city's been a little bit different, but I always open the night talking about work and career, and then that kind of permeates right into the rest of our lives. Something that I was really pleasantly surprised by, not surprised in the sense that I didn't already know this, but in just the way that these conversations develop organically, every city that I went to, we started out the night talking about our own challenges and what we could do about them, sharing problems or success stories or, you know, kind of hashing out issues. And then there's a break. And then in the second half, no matter where we've left off in the first half, no matter which city I was in, the conversation organically turned to what are the larger issues facing our nation, our world, and what can we do about them? Because And that just showed me how kind of unselfish our generation is. I think I hear all the time, you know, critique of millennials as being like very self-indulgent and self-centered and very just self-focused, when I have found us to be very outward-facing and very much concerned with how we can help others or how we can solve problems. And so that's been, I think, one of my most favorite takeaways from this journey.
You know, it's interesting talking about issues of a generation and kind of that big perspective. Even a couple years ago myself, like I would, the issue of like women in finance, like I would, you know, I haven't faced a lot of those issues. So I was kind of blinded to that. But as I started going to conferences and talking to other women, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is a huge problem that mm-hmm. needs to be addressed. And in the financial services industry, I think the latest statistic is that it's 24% women, and it's been just consistent at that level. Like it right. hasn't been growing. Right. And so it's like there's some of these bigger problems there. So I'm so glad that you're addressing them. And I think that as a profession, as a financial industry's profession, like we need to be addressing that as well.
Absolutely.
So there's been a lot of talk about millennials being lazy and entitled. And so what I'm hearing and what I'm hearing you say is that isn't what you found.
Right.
What are millennials' strengths, and how can we capitalize on those in the workplace?
You know, it's so funny that you use the words lazy and entitled, because in my survey, I have asked all of these women, you know, what are some perceptions? Like, what do you think the perception of millennials is like from other people? What do you think that is? And lazy and entitled were like the two top perceptions that they face. And I'm not, you know, it's always a challenging conversation to talk about generations in a broad sense, because obviously we are talking about perceptions and not necessarily fact. It's really impossible to generalize right on an entire generation of people, but there are certainly hallmarks of each generation based on the socio-political climate, economic climate, a host of factors, right, that kind of shape, especially technology, that shape how we see the world and how we move around in it. Millennials, which, by the way, I want to make sure we classify as Americans or as people in the world who are 22 to 35. So I think something I've noticed a lot recently is people complaining about millennials as kids, but millennials are not kids. Some of them are, yes, graduating from college. This is kind of like the last wave of the millennial generation. Gen Z is picking up, and you know, they're kind of the youth of America today. So I want to make sure that we're not talking about kids. We're talking about young adults and people all the way to 35, which actually in the generation world are considered to be aging millennials, which I find really hilarious because I'm one of them. Millennials are, this is not going to come as a shock to you, but I think because we grew up in the technological, kind of like the golden era of tech advancement, and continue to participate in it, I think we're digital natives in the sense that we're really comfortable with technology. And that doesn't apply to every person who, you know, not everyone is working in tech, but we are adept at using modern technology. And because of that, we are great at multitasking. And a million arguments can be made about the merits or the faults of being a great multitasker. But I think millennials are good at balancing a big workload. They're great at digesting and bringing, you know, really taking in a lot of content, being able to make sense of it, and then being able to put a plan into action. A lot of us, the side hustle, which, you know, is a pretty common term now. A lot of us have a side hustle. A lot of millennials have to, and we can talk about that a little bit later, about the reasons why they have to. But so many of us have a variety of interests. Our jobs don't necessarily define us and who we are anymore. And so I think one of the strengths is millennials are great at, you know, developing kind of their individual sense of self and then doing work that really capitalizes on that. I don't know, I find them to be a very motivated group of people who take a lot of initiative. Sometimes that gets dogged as a disrespect for hierarchy or, you know, a disrespect for the way things get done. I think it's great that many millennials have a healthy disrespect for the way things have always been done, because the world is kind of relying on us for progress. So I think we're motivated, we take initiative. Most of the millennials I meet are incredibly hardworking. And so I think those are strengths that any employer, no matter the industry, can capitalize on.
So there's this fairly significant generation gap within the financial planning profession. What can millennials listening to this podcast do to help bridge that gap with the older generations in the workplace?
This is such a great question, Hannah. So this is across industries. I experienced this. It surprises some people, but even in the entertainment industry, which, you know, those who are not in it probably have a view of entertainment as being kind of a very young, progressive, or even the people who are older that are in the entertainment industry are, you know, kind of very forward thinking. There's really still kind of an old guard in certain sectors. And so I experienced this myself. There was just this very significant generation gap. And because of that, really, unfortunately, a misunderstanding of one another. And then that creates a tension. And then that generation gap just kind of gets bigger because we aren't working together, because we are making assumptions about one another that are usually not true. And so we're not capitalizing on each other's strengths. I think one of the best things millennials can do, and I've seen this work, is to really take initiative in reaching out to people in their organization or even just in their industry who are older than them, creating space for those people to share their experience with you. And you need to sit and listen. So it starts, in my opinion, with listening. As much as, you know, industries are evolving, and I can't speak to the financial sector the way you can, but I'm not going to use the word elders, but our colleagues who are older than us, I'm talking 30, 40 years, have so much more experience than we do. They have so much wisdom for us to draw on. And I think, you know, whether it's a mentor or a boss or a colleague that you work with, anyone, I think it's important for millennials to really make an effort to sit down and learn, listen and learn, digest that information, which they should be good at doing, and then figuring out what works for us now. What can we learn from in the past? Let's make sure we don't make some of the same mistakes. How can we look to what's worked and what hasn't worked and evolve our product or our process moving forward? But I think it starts by listening. And I think by doing so, you build a relationship. And relationships are really the only way to break down some of these stereotypes. Because when you know someone, it's different, right? You can say, oh, well, I work with lots of, you know, people in my organization who are Gen X or are baby boomers, but we have a great relationship. We understand each other and vice versa. I think when we, I don't know, instead of kind of talking about it on Facebook, when we actually go and have a conversation with a person in person, it really changes things. So that would be my advice on a good place to start.
And I love it that it starts with us. Like, we're the ones who need to be initiating that conversation.
Absolutely.
Like, we can't be expecting that to come to us.
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's also that stereotype that, like, millennials are just sitting and waiting, you know, to be handed everything on a silver platter. In my experience, that's really not the case, but I know that that is often the perception. And, you know, I also hear from millennials, well, why do I have to take responsibility for everything all the time? Why should it be up to us to kind of go and defend, you know, our generation? They're, you know, the boomers raised us. Why? They should know what they, you know, what they've created. I don't really care too much about, you know, hashing out whose responsibility it is. This is the situation we're in. We are moving into leadership in our organizations. We're a very, very important generation, particularly right now. And so it doesn't really matter at the end of the day who should be taking initiative. I think we should be doing it and really leading the charge and setting an example.
So you're talking about going to other generations. And as you were saying this, the mentoring, just that phrase just kept coming up.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on mentoring? Do you have just any... It's a huge question.
I know. That's like a whole other podcast.
I know.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think, oh, my gosh, mentoring is tremendously, tremendously valuable. In my own journey and path, I have been very intentional about seeking out strong mentors. And because of that, I've seen and have reaped the benefits of what great mentors can provide. And mentoring is a two-way street. I think that, you know, some people forget that a mentor is not just there to, you know, serve you and guide you and give you advice and advance you and champion you and all of that. It kind of goes both ways. And my most successful mentoring relationships have been that. We're helping each other essentially and learning from one another. But absolutely, mentoring is so important. Someone was asking me the other day, well, I just don't really know where to start. How do I find, you know, the right mentor? And I would start by looking inside of your organization. And for some people, that's 10 people. And for some people, that's 50,000 people. But I would start by looking inside of your organization and looking towards someone. And women often ask me, like, well, there's no women in leadership in my organization. Oh, that's fine. I mean, well, it's not fine. But if you don't have any women, which is unfortunate, in leadership in your organization, you know, look towards leaders. A lot of my mentors have been fantastic men in my industry. And I would look towards just people who carry themselves with a lot of integrity and share similar values to you. And then second to that, once you establish a mentoring relationship, you need to be intentional about your questions, and then you need to listen. We could have a whole other conversation about this, but I think that mentoring is really, really important. And at some point, you will cross over the threshold where others will want... others will want... will want your advice too, probably a lot sooner than you think. And so I'm in a position right now where I'm mentoring others, but also still have a mentor for myself. I think that's also really important.
It's the professional development.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
In talking with these millennials across all of these cities, were there any themes that came out about their finances or like their personal finances?
Sure. So a lot of women, I ask in the interview or in the survey, you know, do you feel like you have control over your personal finances? And I hate to report that actually a majority of the women said, no, they do not. They do not feel like they have complete control over their financial health and their financial growth. Very few people said that they did, and very few people said that they didn't want more advice on how to maximize their situation. So most of the people that I met with felt like A, they don't have a lot of control, B, they want more information on how to maximize their personal finances, and then C, a lot of people reported that they didn't have any type of training or guidance in their young adulthood on how to manage their money. And I think that is a really, really important thing that we need to pay attention to. Because if your parents or your school or whoever doesn't sit you down and teach you how to manage, you know, it used to be learn how to balance a checkbook, right? That's not the case anymore. But, you know, learn really how to manage your money. Then how do you learn? How do you learn how to do that? So I think there's an educational component, and it's never too late, obviously, for anyone to learn anything about managing and maximizing their finances better. But I think we still have a long way to go in terms of millennials and their relationship with money. It's really different than other generations.
In the financial planning profession, financial services industry, there's a lot of really, really great advisors, but you have to have $1 million before they'll work with you.
I know.
Or, you know, they have these huge minimums, and there's such a wide open opportunity for people to really speak to millennials. And
oh, definitely. And I think women, I don't want to always come back to it being a gender thing. It just happens to be kind of where my work is right now. But there is a difference between the way women want to and should invest versus the way men often invest. I'm really excited. There's a new company called LVEST, and you should look it up. I love their founder's kind of approach to helping women invest in a way that's right for them based on women's earning potential and earning patterns over time, making smart investments and managing their money in a way that is really more succinct to who they are. And you don't have to have $1 million to start. It's for anybody. And you can invest as little or as much as you want and watch your money grow. I think that's a great way to approach it. So I'm excited to see, and we'll hopefully see more companies like that or financial services firms like that. A lot of millennials feel like financial planning, any type of wealth management, advisory, anything like that is totally out of reach. And in some ways it is. Some of us who have worked at larger companies and are fortunate to have, benefits. I remember the first time calling to talk with my Fidelity advisor about my 401k and all these things. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is such a privilege. I never imagined that I would be able to do this because I'm, just starting out or just getting out of school. And then, we can talk about this or not talk about this, but the big elephant in the room when you talk about millennials and finance is really how millennials manage student debt and how that's impacted our generation in a major way. So I think that too changes our perception on money and how we spend our money. It also changes the way we are able to do that.
It's a really, really important conversation topic, is that student loan debt.
Yep.
When you toured and talked to all these women, did the majority of them have the student loan debt, or how did that change their mindset?
Hannah, to be honest with you, I think that this is one of the biggest divides in the millennial generation. There are millennials whose parents have done very well and they were not impacted by the financial crisis in 2008, and they were able to send them to college and maybe even on to graduate school or law school, et cetera, and they're doing just fine. And then there are people like myself whose parents were impacted and they were not able to help out with college or graduate school. And so, but we were also expected and told that we should make that investment and do that because you can't get a great job or you can't get ahead or you won't be marketable as an employee in the future if you don't make this investment in education. Of course, that investment is thousands of percent, higher. It's way, way, way more expensive than it was in the 90s, 80s, 70s, et cetera. So it's a lot harder to do that. And so people coming out of school in the last, 15 years or so, maybe longer, are really carrying a tremendous amount of debt. And where that becomes problematic is not only just in your month-to-month, day-to-day living, because you're paying that debt off usually as soon as you get out of school. It impacts our spending in the future because in order to buy a car, buy a house, et cetera, of course, they're looking at your debt to income ratio. And people who are making bigger investments by going to more expensive universities, or they're getting a graduate degree, maybe they're going into medical school, your debt to income ratio isn't going to look so great for maybe the first 10 plus years after getting out of school. So it's a lot harder for those millennials to participate in kind of the traditional ways that we expect our economy to perform. It's just been a lot harder, and that's reflected in the data. Millennials are not buying houses and cars and all these other things that you would think you would do in your young adulthood as you're kind of settling down and setting up a family or a home life. It's just not happening. And I think student debt is really one of the main reasons for that.
Is there any solution for this, or is this just the new reality?
Sure, I would love for the federal government to, you know, get involved in helping. Oh my gosh, this is a whole other conversation too. I think so many, you know, the federal government is really profiting off of the interest on at least federal student loans, and then of course there's the entire private sector of student loan providers. I think that we could really, you know, put a surplus into our economy if we looked at everyone who has student debt. We lowered interest rates or made it just so much easier. And there have been big strides in the last 8 years to make this happen. Don't get me wrong. To create different payment plans or ways to kind of manage your student debt that are a little bit easier to manage. That gets your monthly payment lower for people who, you know, just can't afford to make a $1,200 or more student loan payment a month. It helps keep your monthly lower, but it hasn't so far addressed the long term, which is the lower your monthly payment is, you know, are you really ever paying on the principal balance of that loan if you're making that small of a payment over a certain period of time? Right now, the forgiveness period is 25 years. And of course, there are programs for service, public service, and elsewhere where you can have some of your student loan debt forgiven. But I think if we were to kind of help eliminate or alleviate some of that from a large section of our population, we would really improve our economic performance. People would have more money to spend in other places.
Well, and you talk about financial planning, like that's such a different message, or that's such a different service than these high net worth clients who have millions of dollars. You know, it's just a different, almost like a different world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my husband and I, you know, it's January, so we're looking for a new CPA to kind of help us with our taxes. We have kind of a complicated tax return this year, more so than we've had in the past. And the thing we're looking for the most is someone who is, you know, understands student debt and all of the codes related to, you know, tax codes related to your interest in capturing that and what's better for you. Because whether you filed married or single or married, you know, whether you're married or single, you filed married but separate or filing jointly, it impacts your ability, it impacts your student loan payments for the future. And so it's just really, it's permeating kind of every aspect, I think, of millennials who have that, who carry that. It impacts the way that you look at your money entirely.
One of the topics that you're passionate about is negotiation within the workplace. So how did this become a passion of yours?
Well, you know, my dad is a great negotiator. And so I think I was lucky growing up. I used to go with my dad when I was a kid, when he would go to buy a car, and I would watch him, you know, kind of negotiate this purchase. I used to listen in on some of his, you know, business calls when he was talking with clients or, you know, colleagues, et cetera. And I'm listening to them, you know, for better or for worse, you know, not better or for worse, but whether it sounds like it or not, most conversations are negotiations. And so I think I was lucky to kind of be exposed to that. And so I just love it. In graduate school, I took a fantastic entertainment law course with this amazing man named Michael Donaldson, who is a fair use guru and entertainment attorney in Los Angeles, also one of the loveliest people I've ever met. And his class was fantastic. And he actually wrote the book, Negotiating for Dummies. And he wrote another great book called Fearless Negotiating. And Michael, you know, was really able to tap into, you know, my love already of kind of having tough conversations. But Michael really lays out for anyone, whether you know, love negotiating or don't love negotiating, he lays out this kind of really simple perspective on the way to approach these types of conversations. And it's called the wish-want-walk methodology. And more than almost anything, you know, from my studies, this has stuck with me because it is so useful. And moving into any industry, whether you're negotiating your salary or your terms or whatever, you're going to be negotiating with colleagues, clients, people in commerce all the time. And so I think it's important to get really comfortable with that idea and to get really good at it. In the last year, I've talked with lots and lots of people who are negotiating an advancement of some kind, whether it's a title or responsibility, role, new job, a new salary, a raise, etc. And so I've kind of seen what works well and what doesn't work well, but I always encourage everyone that I talk with to just get really comfortable and as confident as you can about your own negotiating skill set. And that's really just getting clear on what you want and being confident and asking for it. That's, in my mind, the best place to start.
It's interesting. I had somebody on the podcast before talking about sales and how mm-hmm. they said the same thing. It's like every conversation, you're always selling. And I love what you said about how you're always, like, every conversation really is a negotiation. And the importance of learning those skills now, that'll just, I think, help you.
Absolutely. I mean, think about your day-to-day at work, whether you're collaborating with a team on a project. I mean, part of collaboration is negotiating. It's kind of coming to the table and making compromise on, you know, anything that you're working on. So the more that you do it, I think the more comfortable you will be. But I always tell people, you know, who are kind of going into a, especially those who are going into a conversation with leaders or a boss or HR or someone about their own contract or their salary, et cetera, at work, first you've got to do your homework. You have to really, really do your homework and equip yourself with the knowledge, do as much benchmarking as you can, talk with other people, ask them. Millennials are actually a lot more open, I found, about discussing their compensation in an attempt to kind of help everybody else get ahead. So it's like, if you're all willing to say, you know, together, even though companies often discourage it, you know, what you're making, it really can help you understand, like, what you should be asking for, and or just where your company, you know, where their job families and their kind of sliding scale on their salary stands, depending on your industry. Do your homework and then formulate a really clear ask. Know definitely what are you wishing for the most? What would be like the ultimate situation? And then you need to know like what you're willing to compromise on. And then you also have to kind of know what you're willing to walk away from, actually. And so that kind of harkens back to the wish, want, walk methodology, which is, what's your ultimate wish? What would you still be happy with? What do you want? And then what are you going to walk on?
One of the topics that gets thrown around a lot in the financial planning world is ownership, even with young advisors, and buying a practice. So do the same negotiation tips that you just mentioned work when you're negotiating kind of these bigger items, if you would?
You know, that is a really tough one. I know that this is popular in your industry and actually among young startups and companies. It's like, we're getting started, come in, we'll pay you less, but over time you will earn a stake in the business, or you will attempt to buy a portion of the practice. For people in their 20s who are coming out of school, if this is your first or second, maybe even third job that you've had, I really don't think that this is a great idea, to be quite honest. I think that you should own your value. And if your value in your industry, say the salary you should be making is, I'm just going to throw a number out there, $75,000 a year, if that's the salary that is, you know, on par with other firms, but the firm that wants to hire you wants to pay you, you know, 40 grand, but they're promising you XYZ over a certain number of years, I don't know if that really benefits you, because too often I have seen people lose out because either they didn't read the fine print, or they didn't understand exactly what they were signing and the stipulations around it, or maybe the business doesn't succeed. Maybe the business fails. The business fails, well, you're really not going to get anything. And then you've worked for a number of years for a much lower salary than you could have been making. So that's just my personal opinion. I would avoid those types of situations. But if you are interested in one, I really think it's important to consult with an attorney who can take a look at what your company is offering you. Because so often we just think that negotiating is a kind of a one-side situation. The company's going to say, here's what we're willing to pay you. Here are the terms. They're non-negotiable. That always gets thrown around, right? They're non-negotiable, but this is what we're offering. And you know, this is how it is over the next 2 to 5 years, etc. First of all, everything is negotiable. Everything. And even if you think it's not, I think it's always worth trying. I think you should review what you're being offered and kind of look at what are the worst case scenarios. Work with an attorney to develop your own set of clauses. Doesn't have to be a lot. So that you are protecting yourself if this is the type of situation, an agreement that you want to enter into. It's really exciting. I mean, I get the enthusiasm behind ownership is a very attractive thing, especially to young people. I mean, you know, for those of us who are very ambitious and who maybe dream of someday having our own practice, it's exciting to think about, oh, wow, I could buy in and maybe become partner, or, you know, maybe really maximize my return over a few years by making this investment of time and work. But I would avoid that when you're first starting out.
Absolutely. And I think one of the points that you had talked about, that you have to be willing to walk away from it.
Yep.
And I don't hear enough people when they talk about succession plans where they're actually willing to walk away from it.
Walking away, no matter what, walking away is so hard. I think it's hard for everybody. I think, you know, inherently many of us, you know, once we've committed to doing something, we want to finish it. We want to do well at it. And so even when things are going south, there's a tendency to want to make the best of it, to save it, to stop the bleeding, right? To make the situation better. And that requires effort. But I think it's so important to know when it's time to walk away from something. So before you enter into any agreement, you know, whether you're working in finance or any other industry, make sure that you understand the exit path before you go in. And nobody wants to think about that, right? Because we want to think, oh, I'm going to be at this company for maybe a long time, and maybe we'll be really successful together, and I'll help them, you know, grow the business, or I'll contribute in a very meaningful way. That's becoming less and less the case in our workforce. People are changing jobs and changing companies more often than I think we used to. So always make sure that you understand the path going in, and that you have the foresight to see the path going out.
We've had people on the podcast who've said that young people just need to understand the risks that business owners are taking when they hire people. And it seems a bit heavy-handed. Is there a balance to this, or kind of what would be your response to that?
Well, I think that is such malarkey. I think, you know, it's so interesting to reflect back on, you know, the last 13 years or so in my own career. And it is so easy, especially I think, you know, after 2008, it became so easy for people to say, you know, there were not a lot of jobs to go around. So people are taking unpaid internships. And I think we are the generation of unpaid interns. And there's this, I think, very unhealthy narrative there, this mindset that's like, oh, you should just be grateful to be here. You should just be grateful to have this experience. You know, I've seen this a lot, and it's happened to me. You should just be happy that we're giving you this opportunity to do this. And in some cases, sure, there were great unpaid internships where I had exposure. I was able to shadow people. I learned a lot about my industry or a certain type of, you know, a certain type of product. But you are not doing your employer a favor by working for them. Okay. Employers need you. And if they didn't need you, they wouldn't be attempting to hire you or hire a team in general. They need a team. Everybody needs a team to grow their business. And there's this mentality, and I think you should really watch out for it, because it can be very passive aggressive, which is we're doing you a favor and you should just be grateful so we can treat you however we want or pay you whatever we want, because you get the benefit of working at this amazing place with this amazing reputation or set of benefits, etc. I agree with you that it is very heavy-handed, but I think when we're younger and we're coming out of school, it feels like that's the only option. It's like, well, I have only done a handful of, you know, summer internships or maybe associate level jobs, and you know, maybe I should just be happy to get what I'm getting. I actually think that that is just a way for companies to pay you less money, and it starts, unfortunately, this mindset, this way of thinking that I feel devalues us over time. And I see this particularly in my conversations with young women. And the data shows that, you know, we're very confident coming out of school and we're very optimistic about our futures, our chances at succeeding in our fields. And then as you know, look 7 to 10 years down the line, the numbers drop drastically in our belief and our ability to reach the levels we want to reach. And so I think some of that thinking starts out when we're getting out of school, and it starts out with this type of, you know, mindset that they're doing you a favor. So I would resist that. I would be as self-aware as you possibly can, but you should also own your value as much as possible, and your value increases over time if you're doing it right.
When people look to hire, I mean, they're now that business role, that business right. owner role. And it's, if they're a bad business owner, that's not your problem.
Right, like exactly.
Just, and there's unfortunately quite a few bad business owners.
There are. And you know what? Everybody is going to have a handful of bad experiences. Your career is not going to be, nobody's is smooth sailing. It's never... You know, sometimes it is just as valuable to learn how not to do things as it is to learn how to do things. And so I can say I have learned just as much from people who were terrible leaders or business owners as I have from those who are fantastic at it. That's when you have to know, you have to have the discernment, which sometimes is more challenging to have when you have limited experience. You should have the discernment to know when you're dealing with someone who really isn't great at what they're doing. Or maybe they're a great person, but they're not a great business owner or operator. And you have to know when to walk away from those types of situations.
So for many people coming out of college, like their first job is the first time that they've been in a professional setting. Do you have any specific pieces of advice that you have on being a professional and making that transition?
Also a whole other podcast, Anna. We could talk about this forever. Yes, I do. First of all, I hope that when you're coming out of college, I truly hope that it is not your first time in a professional setting. I think during school, it's very important, whether it's a semester internship that's part-time or it's full-time in the summer when you're doing summer school, et cetera. I think it's really, really important that you look for apprenticeship and internship opportunities in your field or as close to what you think your field might be. As possible. It is important to collect a diverse work experience. Even if that means, you know, for some people doing maybe an unpaid internship in the summer isn't an option, or they want to do a paid internship, you know, in New York or LA or Seattle or wherever, and it's just not a possibility because they need to work to actually support themselves through school. I understand that as well. I think, you know, any work you can do in anything, whether it's the food service industry or retail, et cetera, any of those jobs is going to help craft you as a professional when you're exiting college. So first of all, try not to let it be your first time that you're going into that situation. But if it is, it is so important that you, like I said earlier, show up and listen. First of all, you got to show up. You got to show up on time. And I think I would do your best to kind of observe the way the culture of your office operates. I think, you know, workplace cultures are evolving and we aren't all, you know, suit and tie anymore. And I think that's great. But every company is different. And I think in the beginning, it's really important to, I'm not saying to, you know, lose your own sense of individual identity at all. I'm just saying, look at what other people are wearing. Observe the little things. How do people keep their workspaces? What's the communication like? How do people talk to one another? What's the preferred, you know, format or methodology for scheduling meetings or taking phone calls or any of those things? How do people communicate? The most important thing is to just be a sponge, soak it up and listen, but show up on time, be ready to work, and always be ready to help. I think it really impresses leaders, and it's actually a huge help to a new boss for you to come in and say, I'm here, I'm ready to work. What can I do for you? How can I help? And then take initiative on getting your job done. You're also coming out of school. I completely understand the instinct and have made this mistake myself. You want to put your own twist on something. You want to put your own spin. You want to make your own mark. I would encourage you to just to wait a little while before you do that, because that opportunity will arise, but your impact will be greater if you've taken the time to really learn your organization, learn the clients, understand the mission, before you kind of come out with your own way of doing things. Show everyone around you respect and build relationships with them so that when the time comes, they're going to want to listen.
I want to ask you one more question. So going back, we had talked about, you know, women in the workplace and in the financial services industry, it's really kind of at this static 24%. Mm-hmm. What can we do to help that? I know it's probably a big question that there might not be any concrete answers, but what are your thoughts on that?
There are a million answers. There are so many things that we can do. And I think the first thing to do, and sometimes this is uncomfortable for people, but the first thing to do is just to admit that there is a problem. Admit that there is an issue and admit that we could all be doing better, everybody, in terms of diversity and inclusion across the board. We know that. So the first thing to do is to accept that. And I always encourage when I talk with business owners and leaders is to just, you know, people say like, well, I don't really see this in my organization. Well, you may not see it, but it's there. It is there, and unconscious bias especially is prevalent in every workplace scenario because we all have biases, and some of them we're aware of and some of them we're not. So the first is to admit that there's a problem. And then you have to really look at, you know, your organization and the best way to serve it. I mean, the data shows that companies with a more balanced leadership, okay, sector, as far as gender is concerned, a good balance of men and women, those companies actually perform better. They make more money. So this is usually the reason that I resort to if like nothing else appeals to anyone, which is, well, would you like to perform better? Would you like your business to make more money? Would you like more money in your pocket? Most people, that is a large incentive. And so if that's the only incentive, oh, you know, I'll take it if it's going to help. But we do perform better. Companies do perform better. So there's that. I think you have to be very intentional about it. And for some leaders, you know, this conversation is uncomfortable. Being intentional about hiring, you know, we want to believe that we're being fair, that we're looking at resumes, and we're going to hire the best candidate for the job. But I think you have to, of course, you should hire the best candidate for the job, but you should be very intentional about pulling together candidates that represent a variety of backgrounds, a variety, you know, both men and women, people of all ethnicities and races and levels of education and experience. I think you have to be intentional about pulling a diverse candidate pool, because your chances of increasing diversity in your workforce are much greater if you do that. So you have to be intentional about it. You have to say, you know, we're gonna balance our board, or we're gonna balance this leadership team, or this role, I want to make sure that we bring in a bunch of really fantastic women to interview for this position. That is going to help tremendously. We also have to, I think business leaders have to look at the talent pool and see the phenomenal opportunity in front of them, which again is that this generation of young women are the most educated in history, and we have there's a tremendous talent pool there that could really, really benefit us. And I think it's very intentional to look directly to a generation of millennials and say, who are the cream of the crop here? Because they're out there. There's tons of them. And how can we get them into our organization? And then how do we develop them, retain them? And then how do we pass on our legacy to them? I think that is really important.
Thank you for joining us. But where can people find you to learn out more about you and the Brave Millennial Project?
Sure. So my website is easy, thebravemillennial.com. And you can see a little bit about the journey that I've been on this year, and also the services that I, consulting services that I offer to organizations who are interested in learning more about their own workplace culture and what they can do to improve it if they choose to. especially for those who are looking to hire, attract and retain, you know, more millennial talent. You can find me there. I'm also on Instagram. That's kind of where I post all of my travels and thoughts and, you know, anything that I'm working on or doing. And I'm also at The Brave Millennial. So that's where you can find me.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Laura.
Hannah, I appreciate you having me so much. And I think this is an important and great conversation. So I'm honored to have talked with you today.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of You're a Financial Planner, Now What? I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I will talk with you again next week.